9. Strewn across the floor of the Bevatron lay 8 persons. None of them was fully conscious. Around them lay littered and smoking ruin, the charred metal struts and concrete that had been the observation platform, the confused tangle of material on which they had once stood. Like snails, medical workers crept cautiously down ladders into the chamber. It would not be long before the 8 bodies were reached, before the power of the magnet had died and the humming stream of protons had dimmed into silence. Tossing and turning in his bed, Hamilton studied the unceasing tableau. Again and again he examined it. Every aspect of the scene was scrutinized. As he moved toward wakefulness, the scene dimmed. As he sank restlessly back into sleep, the scene reemerged, clear, sharp, and totally distinct. Beside Hamilton, his wife twisted and sighed in her sleep. In the town of Belmont, 8 persons were tossing and shifting, alternating between wakefulness and sleep, seeing again and again the fixed outlines of the Bevatron, the sprawled, crumpled figures. Struggling to learn every detail of the scene, Hamilton contemplated each figure inch by inch. First, and most compelling, was his own physical body. It had landed last. Striking the cement with stunning force, it lay sprawled sickeningly, arms extended, one leg crumpled under it. Except for vague, shallow breathing, it made no movement. God, if there were only some way he could reach it, if he could shout at it, wake it up, bellow so loudly that it would rise out of the darkness of unconsciousness. But it was hopeless. Not far off lay the slumped hulk of McFife. The man's thick face bore an expression of furious amazement. One hand was still extended to grab futilely at a railing that no longer existed. A trickle of blood leaked down his fat cheek. McFife was injured. There was no doubt of that. His breathing came hoarsely, unevenly. Under his coat, his chest rose and fell painfully. Beyond McFife lay Miss Joan Rice. Half buried in rubble, she lay panting for breath, arms and legs reflexively struggling to push away the layer of plaster and concrete. Her glasses were smashed, her clothing was rumpled and torn, and an ugly welt was rising on her temple. His own wife, Marcia, was not far off. At the fixed, unmoving sight, Hamilton's heart convulsed with sorrow. She, like the rest, could not be aroused. Unconscious, she lay with one arm bent under her, knees drawn up in a quasi-fetal posture, head turned on one side, singed brown hair spilled around her neck and shoulders. A slow flutter of breath stirred her lips. Beyond that, there was no motion. Her clothing was on fire. Gradually, inexorably, a line of dull sparks made its way toward her body. A cloud of acrid smoke hovered over her, partially obscuring her slender legs and feet. One high-heeled shoe had been torn completely off. It lay a yard or so away, forlorn and abandoned. Mrs. Pritchett was a tubby mound of pulsing flesh, grotesque in her gaudy flowered dress, now terribly burned. Her fantastic hat had been mashed to remnants by falling plaster. Her purse, torn from her hands by the impact, was strewn open. Its contents lay in confusion on all sides of her. Almost lost in the debris was David Pritchett. Once the boy groaned. Once he stirred. A section of twisted metal lay over his chest, preventing him from rising. It was toward him that the snail-paced medical teams were moving. What the hell was the matter with them? Hamilton wanted to scream, to bellow hysterically. Why didn't they hurry? 4 nights had passed. But not there. In that world, the real world, only a few terrible seconds had gone by. Among heaps of tattered safety screen lay the Negro guide, Bill Laws. His lank body twitched, eyes open and glazed. He gazed sightlessly at a smoking heap of organic matter. The heap was the thin, brittle body of Arthur Sylvester. The old man had lost consciousness. The pain and shock of his broken back had driven away the last spark of personality. Of them all, he was the most injured. There they lay, 8 singed and terribly crumpled bodies. A discouraging sight. But Hamilton, tossing and turning in his comfortable bed beside his slim and lovely wife, would have given anything on earth to find himself back there. To return to the Bevatron and rouse his inanimate physical counterpart, and thereby pry his mental self out of the wandering rut in which it was lost. In all possible universes, Monday was the same. At 8:30 a.m., Hamilton was seated on the Southern Pacific commuter's train, a San Francisco Chronicle spread out on his lap, on his way up the coast to the Electronics Development Agency. Assuming, of course, that it existed. As yet, he couldn't tell. Around him, listless white-collar workers smoked and read the comics and discussed sports. Hunched over in his seat, Hamilton moodily considered them. Did they know they were distorted figments of somebody's fantasy world? Apparently not. Placidly, they went about their Monday routine, unaware that every aspect of their existence was being manipulated by an invisible presence. It wasn't hard to guess the identity of that presence. Probably, 7 of the 8 members of the group had figured it out by now. Even his wife. At breakfast, Marcia had faced him solemnly and said,
"Mrs. Pritchett, I thought about it all night. I'm positive."
"Why are you positive?" he had asked acidly.
"Because,"
Marcia answered with absolute conviction,
"she's the only one who would believe this sort of thing."
She ran her hands over her flat body.
"It's exactly the sort of silly Victorian nonsense she'd put over on us."
If there was any doubt in his mind, it was resolved by a sight glimpsed as the train sped out of Belmont. Standing obediently in front of a small rural shack was a horse attached to a cart full of scrap iron. Rusty sections of abandoned autos. The horse was wearing trousers.
"South San Francisco,"
the conductor brayed, appearing at the end of the swaying coach. Pocketing his paper, Hamilton joined the meager crowd of businessmen moving toward the exit. A moment later, he was striding gloomily toward the sparkling white buildings that were the Electronics Development Agency. At least the company existed. That was a helpful start. Crossing his fingers, he prayed fervently that his job was a part of this world. Dr. Guy Tillingford met him in his outer office.
"Bright and early, I see," he glowed, shaking hands. "Off to a good start."
Relaxing considerably, Hamilton began removing his coat. EDA existed, and he still had a job. Tillingford, in his distorted realm, had hired him. That much carried over. One major problem was erased from his notepad of things to worry about.
"Darn decent of you to let me have a day off," Hamilton said warily as Tillingford led him down the hall to the labs. "I appreciated it."
"How did you make out?"
Tillingford inquired. That was a stopper. In Sylvester's world, Tillingford had sent him to consult the prophet of the second Bab. The chances were slight that this also carried over. In fact, it was out of the question. Stalling, Hamilton said,
"Not bad, considering. Of course, it's a little out of my line."
"Any difficulty in finding the place?"
"None at all."
Sweating, Hamilton wondered just what he had done in this world.
It was darn nice of you. The first darn day, like that."
"Think nothing of it. Just tell me one thing."
At the lab doorway, Tillingford halted briefly.
"Who won?"
"Won?
Did your entry take the prize?"
Grinning, Tillingford slapped him warmly on the back.
"By golly, I'll bet it did. I can tell by the expression on your face."
The portly personnel director came striding along the hall, a thick briefcase under his arm.
"How'd he do?"
he demanded with a moist chuckle. Knowingly, he tapped Hamilton on the arm.
"Got a little something to show us? A ribbon, maybe?"
"He's holding back," Tillingford confided. "Ernie, let's give it a write-up in the office bulletin. Wouldn't the staff be interested?"
"You're darn right,"
the personnel director agreed.
"I'll make a note of that."
To Hamilton, he said,
"What did you tell us your cat's name is?"
What? Hamilton faltered.
Friday, when we were talking about it. Darned if I can remember. I want to get the spelling right for the office bulletin.
In this universe, Hamilton had been given a day off, his first working day at the new job, to enter Ninny Numcat in a pet show. Inwardly, he groaned. Mrs. Pritchett's world, in some ways, was going to be more of a trial than Arthur Sylvester's. After collecting all details about the pet show, the personnel director hurried off, leaving Hamilton and his boss standing face to face. The moment had come. It couldn't be put off.
Doctor,
Hamilton said grimly, taking the bit in his teeth.
I have a confession to make. Friday, I was so darn excited about going to work for you that I...
He grinned pleadingly.
Well, frankly, I don't remember a darn thing we said. It's all just a sort of vague blur in my mind.
I understand, my boy,
Tillingford said soothingly, giving him a paternal leer.
Don't fret about it. Plenty of opportunity to go over the details. I expect you'll be here a good long time.
In fact, Hamilton plunged on, I don't even remember what my job is. Isn't that a laugh?
They both had a good laugh over it.
That's certainly amusing, my boy.
Tillingford agreed finally, wiping tears of merriment from his eyes.
I thought I'd heard everything.
You suppose maybe...
Hamilton tried to make his voice sound light and casual.
Just a short briefer course before you leave me off?
Well,
Tillingford said. Some of his humor faded. He gained a solemn, important expression, a look of serious thoughtfulness. A vacant, far-seeing glaze settled over his face. He was contemplating the overall picture.
I don't think it ever does any harm to go over fundamentals. It's important, I always say, to return to basic postulates now and then, so we don't get steered too far off our course.
Check,
Hamilton agreed, praying silently that whatever it was, he would be able to adjust to it. What in hell was Edith Pritchett's conception of the function of a gigantic electronics research combine?
EDA, Tillingford began. As you fully realize, is a major element in the national social stature. It has a vital task to fulfill, and it is fulfilling that task.
Absolutely,
Hamilton echoed.
What we here at EDA are doing is more than a job, more, I dare say, than a mere economic venture. EDA was not founded with the idea of making money.
I follow you,
Hamilton assented.
It would be a small and unworthy thing to boast of that EDA is a financial success. Actually, it is, but that's of no importance. Our task here, and it is a great and rewarding task, goes beyond any concept of profit and gain. This is especially so in your case. You, as a young and idealistic beginner, are motivated by the same kind of zeal that prompted me once. Well, now I'm old. I've done my work. Someday, perhaps not too far in the future, I will be laying down my burden, turning my load over to more eager, more energetic hands.
His hand on Hamilton's shoulder, Dr. Tillingford led him proudly into EDA's vast network of research labs.
Our purpose, he intoned grandly, is to turn the immense resources and talents of the electronics industry to the task of raising the cultural standards of the masses, to bring art to the great body of mankind.
Violently, Hamilton yanked himself away.
Dr. Tillingford,
he shouted, can you look me squarely in the eye and say that? Astonished, Tillingford stood opening and shutting his mouth.
Why, Jack,
he muttered,
what...
How can you stand here reciting all this nonsense? You're an educated, intelligent man. You're one of the world's greatest research statisticians.
Waving his arms wildly, Hamilton roared at the bewildered old man.
Don't you have a mind of your own? For God's sake, try to remember who you are. Don't let this happen to you.
Backing away in dismay, Tillingford stuttered and clasped his hands timidly together.
Jack, my boy. What's come over you?
Hamilton shuddered. It was no use. He was wasting his time. Suddenly, a desire to laugh overcame him. The situation was absurd beyond belief. He might as well conserve his anger. It was not poor Tillingford's fault. Tillingford wasn't any more to blame than the trouser-clad horse pulling the junk wagon.
"I'm sorry," he said wearily. "I'm upset."
"Goodness!"
Dr. Tillingford gasped, beginning to recover.
"Would you mind if I sat down a moment? I have a heart condition. Nothing serious, an odd complaint called paroxysmal tachycardia. Makes the old ticker run fast sometimes. Excuse me."
He ducked off into a side office. The door slammed shut, and the sounds of medicine bottles being hurriedly opened and pills being taken filtered out into the hall. Probably he had lost his new job. Listlessly, Hamilton sank down on a hall bench and groped for his cigarettes. A fine start in his adjustment. He couldn't have made a worse beginning. Slowly, cautiously, the door of the side office opened. Dr. Tillingford, eyes wide and fearful, peeped hesitantly out.
"Jack,"
he said faintly.
"What?"
Hamilton muttered, not looking up.
"Jack?"
Tillingford asked uncertainly.
"You do want to bring culture to the masses, don't you?"
Hamilton sighed.
"Sure, doctor."
Getting to his feet, he turned to face the old man.
"I'd love it. It's the greatest thing invented."
Relief flooded Tillingford's face.
"Oh, thank heaven."
His confidence somewhat restored, he ventured out into the hall.
"You believe you feel strong enough to begin work? I don't want to put too much of a strain on you."
A world composed of and inhabited by Edith Pritchett's. He could envision it now, friendly, helpful, saccharine sweet, doing, thinking, believing nothing but the beautiful and the good.
"You're not going to fire me?" Hamilton demanded.
"Fire you?"
Tillingford blinked.
"Well, what on earth for?"
"I grossly insulted you."
Tillingford chuckled weakly.
"Think nothing of it, my boy. Your father was one of my dearest friends. Sometime I'll have to tell you how furious we used to get at each other. Chip off the old block, eh, Jack?"
Patting Hamilton cautiously on the shoulder, Dr. Tillingford conveyed him into the labs proper. Technicians and equipment stretched out in all directions, a humming, vibrant expanse of busily functioning electronic research projects.
"Doctor,"
Hamilton said without conviction, "can I ask you one question, just for the record?"
"Why, of course, my boy. What is it?"
"Do you remember somebody named Tetragrammaton?"
Dr. Tillingford looked puzzled.
"Oh, what was that? Tetragrammaton? No, I don't think so. Not that I can recall."
"Thanks," Hamilton said drearily. "I just wanted to make sure. I didn't think you did."
From a work table, Dr. Tillingford picked up a copy of the Journal of Applied Sciences for November 1959.
"There's an article in here that's circulating among our staff. It may interest you, although it's somewhat old stuff these days. An analysis of the writings of one of the really significant men of our century, Sigmund Freud."
"Fine," Hamilton said tonelessly. He was prepared for anything.
"As you realize, Sigmund Freud developed the psychoanalytic concept of sex as a sublimation of the artistic drive. He showed how the basic fundamental human urge toward artistic creativity, if given no valid means of expression, is transformed and altered into its surrogate form, sexual activity."
"Is that right?" Hamilton murmured, resigned.
"Well, Freud showed that in the healthy, uninhibited human, there is no sexual drive and no curiosity or interest in sexuality. Contrary to traditional thought, sex is a wholly artificial preoccupation. When a man or woman is given a chance for decent, normal, artistic activity, painting, writing, music, the so-called sexual drive withers away. Sexual activity is the covert, hidden form under which the artistic talent operates when mechanistic society subjects the individual to unnatural inhibition.
Sure, Hamilton said. I learned that in high school, or something like it.
Fortunately, Tillingford continued, the initial resistance to Freud's monumental discovery has been overcome. Naturally, he met terrific opposition, but happily, that's all dying out. Nowadays, you rarely find an educated person speaking of sex and sexuality. I use the terms merely in their clinical sense to describe an abnormal clinical condition.
Hopefully, Hamilton asked. You say there's some remnant of traditional thinking among the lower classes.
Well, Tillingford conceded, it will take time to reach everybody.
He brightened. Enthusiasm returned.
And that's our job, my boy. That's the function of the electronics craft.
Craft,
Hamilton muttered.
Not quite an art form, I'm afraid, but not far from it. Our task, my boy, is to continue the search for the ultimate communication medium, the device which will leave no stone unturned, by which all living humans will be faced with civilization's cultural and artistic heritage. You follow me?
I'm already there, Hamilton answered. I've had a high-fidelity rig for years.
High-fidelity?
Tillingford was delighted.
I didn't realize you had an interest in music.
Only in sound.
Ignoring him, Tillingford rushed on.
Then you'll have to join the company symphony orchestra. We're challenging Colonel T.E. Edwards' orchestra the early part of December. By golly, you'll have a chance to play against your old company. What instrument do you play?
The uke.
Just a beginner, eh? What about your wife? Does she play?
The rebec.
Puzzled, Tillingford let the matter drop.
Well, we can discuss it later. I imagine you're anxious to get to your work.
At 5:30 that afternoon, Hamilton was permitted to lay down his schemata and put away the tools of his craft. Joining the other homeward-bound workers, he made his way gratefully from the plant, out onto the tree-lined gravel paths that led to the street. He was just beginning to look around for the train station when a familiar blue car drove up to the curb and came quickly to a halt beside him. Behind the wheel of his Ford coupe was Silky.
I'll be damned,
he said, or thought he said. Actually, it came out darned.
What are you doing here? I was about to start hunting you down.
Smiling, Silky pushed open the car door for him.
I got your name and address from the registration tag.
She indicated the white slip on the steering column.
You were telling the truth after all. What's the W stand for?
Willibald.
You're impossible.
As he got warily in beside her, Hamilton observed, It doesn't tell where I work, though.
No,
Silky admitted.
I called your wife, and she told me where I could find you.
While Hamilton gazed at her in blank dismay, Silky shifted into low and gunned the car forward.
You don't mind if I drive, do you?
She asked wistfully.
I just love your little car. It's so cute and neat and easy to handle.
Drive it, Hamilton said, still marveling. You called Marcia?
We had a long heart-to-heart talk,
Silky informed him placidly.
What about?
About you.
What about me?
What you like, what you do. Oh, everything about you. You know the way women talk.
Reduced to impotent silence, Hamilton gazed sightlessly at El Camino Real and the streams of cars moving down the peninsula to the various suburban towns. Beside him, Silky drove happily, her small, sharp face bright and contented. In this untarnished world, Silky had undergone a radical transformation. Her blonde hair dangled down her back in two tight yellow braids. She wore a white midi blouse and a conservative dark blue skirt. On her feet were plain, unadorned loafers. She looked, in all respects, like a guileless young schoolgirl. Makeup was lacking. Her coy, predatory expression was absent, and her figure, like Marcia's, totally undeveloped.
"How've you been?" Hamilton inquired dryly.
"Just fine."
"Do you remember," he asked carefully, "when I saw you last? You remember what was happening?"
"Of course,"
Silky answered confidently.
"You and I and Charlie McFife drove up to San Francisco."
"What for?"
"Mr. McFife wanted you to visit his church."
"Did I?"
"I suppose so. You both disappeared inside."
"Then what?"
"I have no idea. Then I fell asleep in the car."
"You didn't see anything?"
"What like?"
It would have sounded odd to say, two grown men rising to heaven on an umbrella, so he didn't say it. Instead, he asked, "Where are we going? Back to Belmont?"
"Of course. What else?"
"To my house?"
Adjustment to this world was going to be a slow process. "You and I and Marcia?"
"Dinner's all ready,"
Silky told him.
"Or will be by the time we get there. Marcia phoned me at work, told me what she wanted from the store, and I picked it up."
"At work?"
Fascinated, he asked, "What, line of business are you in?" Silky glanced at him, perplexed.
"Jack, you're such a strange man."
"Oh?"
Troubled, Silky continued to gaze at him until a muffled squeak of brakes ahead forced her to turn back to the highway.
"Honk,"
Hamilton instructed her. A mammoth oil truck on their right was crowding into their lane.
"What?"
Silky asked. Annoyed, Hamilton reached over and tapped the horn. Nothing happened. No sound came out.
"Why did you do that?"
Silky asked curiously, slowing down to allow the truck clearance ahead of her. Relapsing back into meditation, Hamilton filed away another piece of datum in his storehouse of wisdom. In this world, the category car horn had been abolished, and in the thick homeward-bound traffic, there should have been a constant din. In cleaning up the ills of the world, Edith Pritchett eradicated not merely objects, but whole classes of objects. Probably, at some remote time and place, she had been annoyed by a honking car. Now, in her pleasant fantasy version of the world, such things didn't exist. They simply weren't. Her list of annoyances was undoubtedly considerable, and there was no way to tell what was included. He couldn't help thinking of Coco's song in the Mikado. But it really doesn't matter whom you put upon the list, for they'd none of 'em be missed. They'd none of 'em be missed. Not an encouraging thought. Whatever thing, object, or event had at any time in her 50-odd years stirred the smooth surface of her vapid enjoyment was gently eased out of existence. He could guess a few. Garbage men who rattled cans, door-to-door salesmen, bills and tax forms of all kinds, crying babies, perhaps all babies, drunks, filth, poverty, suffering in general. It was a wonder anything was left.
"What's the matter?"
Silky asked sympathetically.
"Don't you feel well?"
It's the smog, he told her. "It always makes me a little ill."
"What?"
Silky inquired.
"Is smog? What a funny word."
For a long time, there was no conversation. Hamilton simply sat and tried vainly to hang on to his reason.
"Would you like to stop somewhere along the way?"
Silky asked sympathetically.
"For a glass of lemonade?"
"Will you shut up?"
Hamilton shouted. Blinking, Silky shot him a mute glance of fear.
Sorry.
Slumped over, Hamilton fumbled for a labored apology.
New job. Tough going.
"I can imagine."
"You can."
He couldn't keep the icy cynicism out of his voice.
"By the way, you were going to tell me, what's your racket these days?"
"Same thing."
"And what the heck is that?"
"I'm still working at the safe harbor."
A measure of confidence returned to Hamilton. Some things, at least, endured. There was still a safe harbor. some small segment of reality carried over for him to hang his assurance on.
"Let's go there," he said greedily. "A couple of beers before we go home."
When they reached Belmont, Silky parked across the street from the bar. Critically, Hamilton sat inspecting it. At a distance, the bar wasn't particularly changed. A trifle cleaner, perhaps. More spick and span. The nautical element was intensified. The allusions to alcohol seemed to have subtly diminished. In fact, he had trouble reading the Golden Glow sign. The bright red letters seemed to fuse together into a nondescript blur. If he didn't already know what the sign read...
"Jack,"
Silky said in a soft, troubled voice,
"I wish you could tell me what it is."
What is?
"I can't say."
She smiled hesitantly up at him.
"I feel so sort of odd. I seem to have a lot of mixed up memories running around loose in my head. Nothing I can put my finger on, just a bunch of vague impressions."
About what?
"About you and me."
"Oh," he nodded. "That. And McFife?"
"Charlie, too. And Billy Laws. It seems like it happened a long time ago. But it couldn't, could it? Didn't I just meet you?"
She pressed her slender fingers achingly to her temples. Idly, he noticed that she wore no nail polish.
"It's so darn confusing."
"I wish I could help you."
And he meant it. "But I've been a little perplexed the last few days myself."
"Is everything all right? I feel as if I'm just about to step through the pavement, you know, as if when I put my foot down, it'll sink on through."
She laughed nervously.
"It must be time to find myself another analyst."
"Another? You mean you've got one now?"
"Of course."
She turned anxiously toward him.
"That's what I mean. You say things like that and it makes me feel so uncertain. You shouldn't ask me things like that, Jack. It isn't right. It hurts too much."
"I'm sorry," he said awkwardly. "It isn't your fault. No point needling you."
"My fault? About what?"
Let it go.
Pushing the car door open, he stepped down onto the dark sidewalk.
"Let's get inside and have our beers."
Safe Harbor had undergone an internal metamorphosis. Small, square tables, draped with starched white cotton cloths, were neatly spaced here and there. A candle burned and dripped on each table. On the walls hung a series of Currier and Ives prints. A few middle-aged couples sat quietly eating tossed green salad.
"It's nicer in the back,"
Silky said, leading the way among the tables. Soon they were sitting in the dark shadows of a rear booth, menus open in front of them. The beer, when it came, was about the best beer he had ever tried. Examining the menu, he discovered that it was the real McCoy, genuine German Bock beer, the kind he could seldom locate. For the first time since entering this world, he began to feel optimistic, even cheerful.
"Here's a rat down your shirt,"
he said to Silky, lifting his mug. Smiling, Silky did the same.
"It's good to be sitting here with you again,"
she told him, sipping.
"Sure is."
Fussing with her drink, Silky asked,
"Do you recommend any particular analyst? I've tried hundreds. I'm always going on to the next one in line, trying to find the best. Everybody has one he recommends."
"Not me," Hamilton said.
"Really? How eccentric."
She gazed past him at the Currier and Ives print on the wall behind the table. It showed a New England winter in 1845.
"I guess I'll go over to the MMHA and see their consultant. They usually can help."
"What's the MMHA?
"The Mobilized Mental Hygiene Association. Aren't you a member?" "Everybody's a member."
"I'm a marginal character."
From her purse, Silky got out her membership card and showed it to him.
"They handle all your mental health problems. It's wonderful. An analysis any hour of the day or night."
"Regular medicine, too?"
"You mean psychosomatics?"
"I suppose so."
They take care of that, too. And they have 24-hour dietetic service.
Hamilton groaned.
Tetragrammaton was better.
Tetragrammaton?
Silky was suddenly floundering.
Do I know that name? What's it mean? I have a kind of vague impression that...
Sadly, she shook her head.
I just can't fix it.
Tell me about dietetics.
Well, they take care of your diet.
So I gathered.
The correct food is very important. Right now I'm living on molasses and cottage cheese.
Give me sirloin steak,
Hamilton said feelingly. Shocked, Silky gazed at him with horror.
Steak? Animal flesh?
You bet, and plenty of it, smothered in onions with baked potato, green peas, and hot black coffee.
Horror turned to revulsion.
Oh, Jack!
What's wrong?
You're a savage!
Leaning across the table toward the girl, Hamilton said,
What do you say we get the heck out of here? Let's go park on some back road and have sexual intercourse.
The girl's face showed only puzzled indifference.
I don't understand.
Hamilton sagged.
Forget it.
But...
Forget it!
Moodily, he gulped down the remains of his beer.
Come on, let's go home and have dinner. Marcia's probably wondering what happened to us.